In just a moment, Keys to the Capitol. Keys to the Capitol, the NBC network radio production show that takes you inside the official doors of Washington, D.C. and probes the issues and personalities in the news each week. And here's a reminder, there's also Listen to Washington every Tuesday night on NBC Radio with Holly Wright as your host, taking you behind the scenes with the personalities of Washington, D.C. In just a moment, listen to Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
Big three unity? Right now, it's high.
New hurdles ahead for Eisenhower administration.
Wall Street sets a record. Business doesn't.
New discipline for the middies and the cadets.
NBC News brings you Keys to the Capitol, a transcribed program of informal discussion by NBC Washington reporters and commentators on issues and measures. NBC News has given these correspondents the assignment of taking you with them behind official doors where opinions are formed and policies are formulated. Tonight you will hear Richard Harkness, Herb Kaplow, Leif Eade, and Arthur Barrio in an exchange of fact and opinion on controversies and problems current in national affairs. Listen now to Keys to the Capitol. First, here is NBC Washington correspondent Richard Harkness.
Well, gentlemen, I think, as any of us would admit, at least if we're honest, that any family has its ups and downs in family relations. One issue brings a cat and dog fight around the dinner table, but the next day it's all peace and harmony. Now, the same point applies, I think, to the Big Three. We recall how Secretary of State Dulles flew to Paris. He snubbed Premier Mendes France and then came home talking about agonizing reappraisal. Then the Secretary of State and the French Premier kiss and make up, just like a family. Now, that's where the Franco-American relations stand tonight, I submit. After the visit here of the puffy little sharp-minded Mendes France, Paris and London now stand together on a major issue that is keeping British troops on the continent of Europe, and now Paris and Washington together on a common policy on Russia's bid for peaceful coexistence. Now, there are differences on Southeastern Asia between our two countries. Mendes France makes very clear that he wants out of Indochina at almost any cost, because if staying in means trouble, well, the French do not want a drain in that part of the world. And Mendes France, for instance, does not share our enthusiasm for training a native Vietnam army. But the test of our relations came when Mendes France stood before the United Nations in New York after he talked here in Washington, when he proposed a meeting with Malenkov with one if the Russians show good faith by discussing a peace treaty for Austria. And that, of course, is exactly the American position. Now, this does not mean that we will have smooth sailing with the French from now on. But only a short time ago, to get this into perspective, when the French Assembly turned down EDC, we over here were sharply critical of the French. Today, after the Mendes France talks in Washington, after Mendes France makes the rearming of Western Germany the first requirement for a talk with Moscow, there's harmony around the family dinner table right now. Do you think, Leif, that this harmony will carry on, continue?
Well, I think that depends pretty much on how Mendes France gets along with his own home folks. He's all right now, it seems to me, with the Big Three, with the other two members of the Big Three, but he still has his biggest job, which is at home, getting through his economic program. And this may give him a help. They may one interact on the other. But there is where his big trouble is. He's the first French leader, it seems to me, since the war, who has had real energy and dynamic qualities.
Well, he certainly has that. And the strange thing is what you brought to my mind, is that here's a man who is an expert on the home front economy. Mm-hmm. Yet all of his accomplishments so far have been in the international field. Of course, he had to get his house in order internationally, stop the drain and into China, for instance.
That was the running sore in France. It gave him big prestige when he stopped that.
Before he could turn to the home front economic problems. But when he tries to really assess, collect an income tax over there, put through some political reforms, he'll run into the French special interests, the lobbyists.
There are millions of special interests.
Wasn't Mendes France the fellow who was reportedly originally right back a number of years ago about the economic situation there? Doesn't necessarily mean he'll be able to carry it off now.
No, there have been several men who've been right. You remember that little manufacturer down the Pinay, wasn't it, who tried to do the same thing, but he was thrown out. And he said he'd never go back in that bear cage again.
And, of course, there's a great deal behind this milk-drinking routine of Mondes France. It is an economic problem involved there, and while he's dramatizing
it
with the...
In France, the wine industry is considerably bigger than the dairy industry.
And so we hear from our wine
connoisseur. More political.
While he's also pleased us and pleased the British, doesn't he also face the problem about France's reaction as a whole to this German rearmament business?
Well, of course, that's where he's proved to be a smart politician, because he immediately, upon taking office, began going on Radio France every week, a la Roosevelt, mm-hmm. with a type of fireside chat. And he feels, I'm sure, that he has sold the French people. I happen to... this is his attitude, let me put it this way, that over in France, 1/4 of the people vote communist. Now, he's convinced that at least 1/2 of those pro-communist voters do so only out of a sense of protest, of frustration. He believes that he's showing the French people that they can do something by themselves, that they can lift themselves by their own economic bootstraps. And he believes that he can cut down to a very big portion that communist vote over there. Incidentally, on the milk-drinking routine, so I'm over here, and everybody else was having champagne to drink, and the butler brought a silver tray with about a 12-ounce glass of milk for Mondes France. I've never seen an unhappier-looking man, because he said, since it got around that he was a milk drinker, that he'd been offered about 2 quarts of milk a day over here, which was more than anybody can really stand.
Incidentally, did any of you see a report, which I think I saw, having to do with the fact that people are starting to drink more milk in France? I think that maybe this dramatization
sure
of
that's
that,
no thing. Yeah,
but as Lou pointed out,
I don't know where.
Lou points out that wine industry is still a big thing over there.
And it's powerful politically. It's powerful, there's one of the places where he's going to run into trouble as soon as he tries to set the budget in order, because the export of wines is subsidized.
Well, to get back to the original idea here of the permanence of the Mondes France regime, does it appear to any of you gentlemen that even if Mondes France is deposed, and we don't want to bury him at this point, even if he is deposed, the French government is now committed to a policy of rearmament of Western Germany. Is it that embedded yet?
That will be ratified before there's any.
That's his first order of business. That is a matter of confidence, and he has appealed to the French people more than any recent leader. Because they have a feeling that finally we've got somebody who can do something in Paris, who can lead us out of this.
I love this business of using the letters PMF, a la FDR, that's been started over there.
One thing strikes me, I just mentioned it there in that little introductory speech of mine, if I may call it a speech, and that is the effect on our whole Far Eastern relations of these latest show of Chinese communist barbarism in taking our 13 Americans, 11 airmen and 2 civilians, clapping them into jail for 4 years up to a life imprisonment on charges of spying. It seems to me that that has cut off, if chance there were, and I doubt it if there really were, any chance of recognition of communist China, of any kind of negotiations with the communists, and would set back rather seriously any hope of progress in this field of peaceful coexistence. Why in the world the Chinese, with their inscrutable Oriental minds, chose this very time to pull a stunt like that is just beyond my comprehension.
Of course, it might be another bargaining setup they might be working toward. You can't exactly see what it would be. Might be the same old thing of recognition or admittance to the United Nations, any one of those.
Well, yes, but they've sealed, or they've definitely sealed that by this latest.
They've often done that, haven't they, Dick? When what to us would seem logical to play friendly, they have often come in with some clincher like that, which would seem to be exactly the opposite.
I've never seen them pull quite this. In Korea, while they were at the conference table negotiating a truce, they'd put on quite an offensive. But that was in order to bring a military victory to put on the bargaining table to weaken our position. I'm somewhat struck.
It seems pointless, this one does.
I certainly know nothing about it, but I know our top officials have the very definite impression that the Russians are more than a little disturbed by the Chinese communist action, that the Russians do not want war. They're trying to guide us into this peaceful coexistence, and that the Russians are quite upset when the Chinese communists pull any stunt like this, and because it, there might open up then a war between ourselves and the Chinese in which the Russians would be dragged. I don't know whether that's in the Chinese communist mind or not, but it's really a hideous possibility.
Just about to say, it seems clear and plain that they didn't receive any Moscow guidance on this one. There are people who seem to think they don't move unless Moscow orders it, but it would seem not in this case.
Dick, you brought up this question of the prisoners, which seems to bring into focus a domestic problem we have tied into this foreign policy matter, the open schism that seems to have developed between this position of Senator Noland and the president. It's inconceivable, or it's somewhat incomprehensible, to figure that the president's spokesman in the Senate would have feelings on foreign policy which are quite opposite to those of the president. But that's one of the problems which President Eisenhower seems to be facing at the present time, and is one of a few others that he will face in the new Congress. There is also, of course, the underlying struggle which we can sense within the Republican Party for control of the party, and the resolution of that in the 1956 presidential convention. I think that the McCarthy censure motive is, of course, illustrative of that in various of its aspects. There's also, of course, the Democratic position, the Democrats taking over Congress, though by not very many, taking over both houses, and just be completely ruffled and angry at these party of treason charges which have been leveled against them. I spoke to some Democrat today, and that was practically one of the first matters out of his mouth, was the fact that this was a phony charge, and you could very easily sense that that is going to be brought up in a great deal of detail by the Democrats. Senator Johnston, I think, has indicated that when he takes over his committee, the Civil Service Committee, the Civil Service problems comes under his committee, they will look into this statement that 6,000-plus security risks have been fired by the Eisenhower administration. They want to find out who hired them in the first place and what the details are. The matter of Dixon Yates, of course, will come up. We don't know exactly in what detail. There will be the question of a new farm bill. And despite all the objections put forward to the flexible support plan of Secretary Benson, there are some indications that there may not be a radical change in the new farm bill. It expires in 55. A new bill must be adopted. Senator Ellender, who will take over the Senate Agriculture Committee, has indicated that he wants to wait a while and see how this Benson plan works. There is, of course, a question of taxes, which is always political dynamite. The president, or at least there has been a report, that the president is going to try and block any cut in the excise taxes on alcoholic beverages, on cigarettes and the like. That is supposed to go out April 1st. He reportedly doesn't want to see them cut if this report is authentic. All these are things that will face President Eisenhower in the next Congress. And it's a Congress of a strange nature because no one exactly knows who controls it. Now, the Democrats have this slight majority, but there are all sorts of cross feelings there, all sorts of opinions, and it might very well be conservative elements in both parties that may dominate or not. I don't know how you gentlemen feel about it, but it was sort of a great big question mark as we go into 55.
Well, it's been pretty much of a coalition government ever since the war. I mean, the coalition of conservative Democrats and Republicans was the one that headed off the Truman domestic program, certainly, and was also the same one that gave him his foreign
program. Well, do you think, Leif, that the next Congress is going to be the same nature? And what would be the result?
Yes, I think that these coalition governments, coalition Congresses, coalition power in Congress is going to be dominant for quite a long time.
Well, these various subjects I've brought up, how would they be affected by this if it's the same?
These subjects you brought up are almost purely political, aren't they?
Well, of
building
course.
Building a record for 1956.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course.
Mostly the farm thing, as you say, the Democrats are not going to bring back the flat 90% of parity and pile up the surpluses again.
Of course, they didn't receive any mandate to do so.
No.
Well, speaking of control, don't you think that secretly there are some Democrats up on the Hill who wish they hadn't got control at this time? They would prefer to have waited two more years.
The Senate thing puts them out in the spotlight. Senate controlled by that narrow majority. They could, anything goes wrong with their blame for it.
Do you think President Eisenhower in 56 will talk about a do-nothing 84th Congress?
Yes, no? If it might get votes. Herb, going to your first point, Senator Nolan's speech, it seems to me that there's a somewhat of a misconception of Senator Nolan's position. We say that he's administration leader on Capitol Hill. I think a lot of people think that he is the White House minion on the Hill, if I may put it that way. Actually, Senator Nolan was elected head of the Republican senators by the senators themselves. The White House had little or nothing to say about his choice. Now, on his calling for a reappraisal of American foreign policy in peaceful coexistence, it seems to me that Senator Nolan has raised some questions which the American people are asking about peaceful coexistence. I know those questions are in my mind. For instance, at lunch the other day, I listened to a man talk who was back from Moscow. He sat down at a long table with Malenkov. Malenkov made it very clear that he'd welcome a Big Four conference. In fact, he said we were allies during the war, Germany twice made war, World War. Why can't we get together and talk it over? Which sounds fine. However, my friend went ahead and, in questioning the Russian dictator, developed very clearly that the communists were not letting up on their long-range objectives whatsoever, that even with peaceful coexistence, they would try to propagandize, they would try to infiltrate and subvert. Now, that being the case, and I think there's no doubt of it, really, it seems to me that somebody in the administration, President Eisenhower, certainly Secretary of State Dulles, should answer some of the questions that Senator Nolan, as senator from California, got up and raised in the Senate the other day.
Well, of course, Secretary Dulles' answer to that is, I believe, that there's a constant review and a constant answer to those questions being put out, and I don't want to miss...
That doesn't answer the question that's in my mind, and if I read Senator Nolan's speech correctly in the congressional record, it didn't answer Senator Nolan's question. That was, with peaceful coexistence, how do you stop the communists from nibbling away at your country's by propaganda and infiltration?
Well, I didn't. I read Senator Nolan's speech too, and I didn't find out how he proposed to do it.
He was questioning.
Well, he was making some flat statements. For instance, he said that coexistence means atomic stalemate. Atomic stalemate means ultimate communist victory.
With the Reds nibbling away, propagandizing and subverting.
Well, sure.
Right.
Supposing Moscow just relaxes and doesn't use its armies in outright war or start revolutions or anything like that, but does simply propagandize and subvert, what are we going to do about it?
Well, that's the answer
I mean, what can you do about it?
Big domes here in Washington.
There is a report, if I can just mention this at this time, that the president is setting up some sort of a group to study this idea of competitive coexistence. I think that's what they call it now.
This
idea of an economic battle.
Yeah, well, that
being resigned to this for a long period of years.
Change the basis from military to economic.
That's just what we need.
One more study. Well, we probably ought to have another study here, too, another economic study. Because, you know, it's almost 25 years, almost to the day, since the big 1929 bust in the stock market. That's the one that the Show Business Weekly Variety banner headlined on the front page, Wall Street Lays an Egg. And this week, stock prices rose up to the record that had stood for 25 years and set a new all-time high. Now, there's some people who are worried that maybe we're building up to another big bust. Of course, nobody knows the answer to that one. The pessimists have been forecasting depression ever since the end of World War II. And, of course, if they keep on forecasting depression long enough, they're bound to be right someday, unless somebody's quietly repealed all the so-called laws of economics. But this bull market of 1954 is a lot different from the one of 1929. The underlying economic conditions of the country are different. And you've got to remember that we've had a lot of inflation since 1929. The dollar itself is a lot cheaper. It doesn't go as far. So prices are much higher there as they are everywhere else. You always have a lot of explanations on why the stock market goes up, but a lot of them strike me as being strict rationalization. But in a situation like this, there's always one factor, and that's what they call confidence. The confidence of a lot of people with money to invest or money to risk that tomorrow's business is going to be better than today's business. And that profits and dividends will be better, too. You can't argue with this confidence. It's either there or it's not there. and it's a curious thing. Right now, business is good, but it's not setting any records. Car loadings, which is one way of measuring the economic activity in the country, have turned up, but they're still lower than they were a year ago, and that was after the decline had set in. We're in an upswing in business in general, but it's largely a seasonal fall upturn. A little better than usual, but nothing spectacular. And you have to remember that we didn't get any seasonal boost last spring. That was the one the president was waiting for. Investments in plant and equipment by corporations, which is another economic indicator, fell off a little this year, and the forecast is for another drop next year. A bright spot, of course, is construction, housing, which has been booming along as usual with another shot in the arm given by the new and still more liberal housing law, making it still easier for people to borrow to buy houses. And right now, at this time, of course, the automobile business is, industry rather, is busy turning out the new 1955 models. But none of the conservative economists is going out on a limb right now to predict bigger and better for 1955. And nobody can give you a good reason for Wall Street's excitement except that one thing, confidence.
Leaf, I was wondering, as you were discussing the business outlook here, have you heard anything about, any more, about the government channeling production into these isolated areas? There aren't too many, but there are some, where business has been bad. I haven't heard a word about that lately. I'm thinking now of New England. Massachusetts has been pretty rough up there. And if you remember, a few months ago, there was some talk, and the government said, well, we'll try to take care of it by channeling production to you.
Oh, yes, that's going on. As a matter of fact, Senator Kennedy and Senator Saltonstall of Massachusetts got together not so long ago, discussed it at the White House. Yes, that program is quite active, I think.
They were getting some Navy ships built up there in Massachusetts.
Yeah, they lost out on some of those.
They lost out on some, and it hurt Senator Saltonstall in the election.
There was another report a couple of days ago that they're looking forward to this next year as being a tremendous year for the European economy, which, of course, would affect us.
Well, the European economy has recovered
tremendously.
It's in good shape.
Yeah. Before, a couple of years ago, they were worried that any downturn in the United States would mean a very sharp downturn in Britain or in Europe because they were so dependent on it. But all of a sudden, they seem to go on their own.
Well, wouldn't that certainly be a factor in keeping our own level up?
Not nearly as much, no. They'd always look to the American market and to the American money market for money to borrow. They'd always look to that as being the balance wheel in the whole world, which, of course, it is, because it buys a lot of stuff, but here lately, they've gone off more independently than we have, and we don't sell them nearly as much as they sell us.
Well, am I only getting selected reports or something? But it seems to me that every time I hear a businessman speak, business is good.
It is good. There's no doubt about it. But there's nothing. That we're not breaking any records.
Well, of course, you don't necessarily have to break records to stay solvent.
No, nobody's forecasting any depression.
Mm-hmm. If it stayed at present levels, everybody would be happy more.
I suppose so, except the people without a job and except those manufacturers who aren't sharing in it right now.
Can an economy stay at a level like that, at a steady level? Does there have to be a...
It could go along on a sort of a plateau for quite a long time.
Yes,
This one has been quite a long time. The 1920s, there was pretty much of a plateau and price-wise all through the 1920s while the stock market was building up.
Well, if there is this, what we were talking about before, this competitive coexistence, that certainly would affect our economy. If it's a long-range...
If we could get into a long-range program of building up the free world somehow, with private business and government cooperating, that would give us a tremendous stabilizing thing in this country.
Well, fellas, to turn away from economics for the moment here, we... let's get back down to earth, out of the theories, let's say. You know, this week the middies and the cadets over there at Annapolis and West Point hit the news, and not in the way that we usually think of through their football game this Saturday, but in a way which has led some people to say that they think the freedom of speech is being curtailed, and this is one step forward in that direction. The hot issue being that Midshipmen and the West Point cadets have been ordered not to debate on the subject of recognizing Red China. The theory being, it would seem, that the subject is too controversial, even though it's a favorite among all the college debating teams right at the moment. It was interesting this week also to see Mr. Eisenhower's comments on that when it was presented to him at his news conference. He said that he respects the opinions of the superintendents, and undoubtedly they must have their good reasons for telling the boys they can't discuss the recognition of Red China. But he thinks that the cadets and the midshipmen would use good judgment, and that he himself would permit them to speak. Of course, behind this, as we well know, is the old idea that the military does not question policy of the government. And the cadets and the midshipmen, it is argued, are in the service, so therefore they have no right to discuss it. They have no right to question policy of government. But those who would allow them to do so say that, well, they aren't actually in service, they're just students. So there's been quite a furor created by this, editorials in the leading papers throughout the country. The cartoonists are having a field day. And many people seem to think these regulations in this particular instance should be relaxed. However, the idea being, as we said, that if it is the policy of government not to permit the officers to question without dire results, as we've seen in some cases, therefore we might assume that this policy could go right down through the line and prevent the middies and the cadets, granted the fact they are in service, prevent them from also questioning anything that the government might have to say about the Far East. Do you think it's a curtailment of freedom of speech, or do you think they have the right to? They should have the right to do it?
Well, I'd like to get on record very definitely that I think it was a tragic mistake to tell these cadets, midshipmen, that they cannot debate and should not debate a controversial subject. Because we no longer have old-line military men in the old-time sense. Any lad who's going to become an officer and rise through the ranks in our military service is going to become, well, what General Eisenhower did, for instance, what so many of our top military men have, and that is international politicians, I use that word in its good sense, they go into diplomacy, they have to handle so many problems which has very little to do with shot and shell, as the old-time military men did. And to curtail these lads' thinking, to say that you should not project your arguments, you should not discuss controversial subjects like this, I think it's almost putting them in a mental straitjacket, and it's a very deep, serious mistake.
As I understand it, they are taught the theory of communism, aren't they?
Well, yeah.
As part of the
Communist Manifesto is studied.
Don't let certain senators hear that, then.
Art, I more or less can understand the peculiar problem which faces the military academies, and in light of this, I think perhaps we might, with your kind permission, of course, extend this to non-military universities. This problem has come up in civilian universities, where it would seem to be of a somewhat more different nature. These people aren't under any of the restrictions of a military man would be. And it would seem to me that by curtailing this, and as far as I can understand, it's largely been pressure of, don't say anything against established United States policy. Well, of course, policy is only derived, it seems to me, from argument. As long as it's peaceful argument, that's supposed to be a basic plank of American democracy, is to discuss these things both ways and then come up with a result.
Well, it would seem to me that if this ban were to be carried out into our universities and our colleges throughout the country, then we would have something to fear. That certainly would be...
Well, you do have it at one college
in Roanoke. I think it's because look, heaven only knows all the officers who've been stationed in foreign countries on occupation duties, for instance. At first, once the shooting stops, then they are the governors of these things, dealing with civilian life, so that they ought to know something about what goes on in the world instead of just troop maneuvering and supplies and so forth.
Well, I don't want boys coming out of West Point and Annapolis with blinders.
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you heard Arthur Berrio, Leif Eade, Herb Kaplow, and Richard Harkness. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at this same time each week. This is the NBC Radio Network.